Hey there.
Hi, Allie. I'm here
How
for
are
you.
you?
Good, good, good. Doing well myself.
Good.
Here comes Dr. Antoneta as well.
Yeah, is he? Oh, there he is. Perfect.
Hi, Dr. Antoneta.
Hey, how are you, Marco?
I'm doing well,
Dr.
doing
Antoneta,
well. Hey, Hale, how are you?
thanks for hopping on. I was gonna put myself on mute. I just wanted to make sure you guys connected okay.
Okay, thanks so much. Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
Appreciate it. How are you doing, Dr. Antoneta? Nice to
Doing
see
good.
you.
Yeah.
Thank you again for your time. I appreciate it. Appreciate it. Obviously, we're going to talk a little bit about your recently published paper on the 2024 McDonald criteria, focused in on individuals with non-specific symptoms or incidental imaging findings, obviously in a multi-centered study. So before we jump into any of the actual findings specifically, just give a little bit of background for our audience on just kind of the goals and the intentions behind this study in general.
Yeah, so you might be familiar, Marco, about, and your audience is likely familiar with 2024 revisions to the McDonald's criteria. And those were published last year, and they included several changes, and principal among them, and probably the largest philosophical change, is that we can now make a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis in individuals who are asymptomatic and have incidentally been found to have lesions on MRIs of the brain, and also in individuals who have what we call our symptoms not specific for MS. And these could be symptoms that are either short duration or might not get to the bar of what we call a typical clinical attack or progression of neurological symptoms. And as a reminder, the 2017 criteria, so the previous iteration, required you to have either a typical attack or progression from onset in order to be in the diagnostic criteria. So really a big departure from that. And so what we were hoping to do with this study, we made use of our data set, which is the CAPS-MS study. This was a study that was designed to actually get the central vein sign into the diagnostic criteria for multiple sclerosis. And we decided to use this study to test two populations. And so we kind of did this before the criteria established that you could make a diagnosis in these individuals. But we said, well, logically, people can present to an MS provider in one of two ways, either with classical typical symptoms, either an attack or progression, or with radiologically isolated syndrome or symptoms that are not specific for MS. The study broke down almost 50-50. 50% of people had, either a typical attack or progression. And then 50% of the study had either radiologically isolated syndrome or symptoms not specific for MS. So it was the perfect kind of test bed to see, hey, can we see how much does applying the 2024 criteria increase the yield of diagnosis in these very special groups? I will say also as a comment that there is a ton of literature on radiologically isolated syndrome. We've studied that, been studying that for about 15 years. And we kind of know how those patients behave. The people with symptoms not specific for MS, they're included in the criteria because we thought that it didn't philosophically make sense to have a higher bar if you had not specific symptoms than if you had no symptoms at all. But it's not a group that we've studied in any amount of detail. So this is one of the first studies that's doing that.
Well, I was going to ask you, Dr. Antoneta, obviously, the findings kind of showed that nearly one out of the five patients met the 2024 criteria without a typical attack. So, in your opinion, how do you kind of view these data specifically? And do you feel as though that the inclusivity of these new guidelines are working as they were intended to? Or do you feel as though that when you see one out of five, you feel as though that we might be moving the goalpost just a little bit too much? Where, how do you view kind of that data specifically?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to remember that, I think the one in five number seems about right to me, to be honest, right? When we get patients referred to the Mellen Center, we many times get people who have radiologically isolated syndrome or many times symptoms not specific for MS. And I would say it's about that. It's about one in five people where you say, you have non-specific symptoms, your MRI just shows some spots, which are nothing. But there's about 20% of times where we see these folks and we say, I looked at your brain MRI and it indeed does look like multiple sclerosis. The reality of the referral pattern is that, if you have symptoms not specific for MS, you don't show up to an MS provider. You typically show up to an MS provider when you have symptoms not specific for MS, and either you have a family history or somebody's already done an MRI and they've said, hey, this kind of looks like MS. So I don't think that, that population is a population that's probably been slightly selected for a higher likelihood of multiple sclerosis. If you were to take the entire population of the United States who had non-specific neurological symptoms, I think your numbers would be a whole lot lower than 1 in 5.
That's kind of what I figured, but that thank you for that insight as well. One of the things that also sort of stuck out to me, Dr. Antoneta, was that the the sensory, the visual, and the cognitive symptoms sort of tracked with diagnosis, while the gastrointestinal and bladder symptoms never sort of showed that same association. So is that distinction enough that obviously this is a specific patient population for this study, but can we take those findings and kind of broaden them out to more clinical care, or do you feel as though that this isn't enough of a signal to officially say that we should be changing the way we triage patients?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is we decided to look at this because we thought it was interesting, right? You had these people with not non-specific symptoms. The question is, are there certain symptoms that are more likely to be associated with MS or not? And I think the signal is real. I mean, our sample size is, close to 200 people, so it's not a small number of individuals. And I think, to me, it's made me reflect on my clinical practice. Well, when somebody reports memory or concentration problems, when somebody reports sensory problems that are clearly neurological, those are the people that, I'm probably going to be more worried about. Some of the, conditions that were not associated with MS, are stuff that you kind of would intuit they wouldn't be associated with MS. Lower back pain, for example, was one of the ones that came up that was not associated with MS. Lightheadedness, not necessarily associated with MS. And then bladder bowel, interesting, because that was one that I wasn't expecting. And we think sometimes prodrome of MS may present with bladder bowel symptoms. So that one I'm taking with a grain of salt. But I think it's a real signal. So I think people with sensory symptoms, people with cognitive symptoms, are people that, at least I'm going to pay special attention to, when they come in my clinic and I'm thinking about a diagnosis of MS.
And that kind of leads me to my next question, kind of talking about patients. You mentioned that obviously the diagnostic criteria kind of opens the floor up for more patients to have that MS diagnosis. So, without the longitudinal confirmation, how do you sort of counsel a patient who might be sitting in kind of that diagnostic gray zone area that you're not 100% certain about if they have MS or not? You're still kind of waiting on decisions or what to do next. How do you kind of counsel a patient, and what do you feel as though are kind of the appropriate next steps? Because we've heard from other people that there's still a bit of kind of like confusion a little bit on how to actually apply some of the diagnostic criteria in real world. So, just talk a little bit about some of that application and when you do have a patient who might be kind of sitting in that 50-50 gray zone per se.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. And it brings me to kind of one of the other things that we did in the study, which is, if you have a person who has symptoms that are not specific, and if you have a person who have, asymptomatic with radiological onset, right? As a person who got an MRI just kind of incidentally. The reality is that, those individuals, in order to kind of get into the diagnostic pathway, have to have at least two lesions in typical locations, right? And you could say there's a lot of kind of gray zone, like I'm not sure what that person has. What should I do with this person? And that's where the criteria embed these very specific biomarkers, right? And I think, the central vein sign, oligoclonal bands, and the presence of new lesions developing on MRI, those give you a lot of confidence. And so, just to go back to our CAV study, what we demonstrated with the CAV study was, that these measures are associated with the disease and they're specific to the disease. So oligoclonal bands predicts a second clinical attack. Dissemination in time on MRI demonstrates that you're developing new lesions, and therefore you're pretty confident that you need to diagnose that person and, more than likely start treatment. And then for central vein sign, what got it into the criteria were in part studies that showed that its diagnostic performance compared to oligoclonal bands, which we already know is a specific test and predicts a second clinical attack, was as good or better than those. So I think using these very specific imaging markers, biological markers such as positive CSF or new lesions on MRI, gives you that confidence. And that's why it's built in that way in the criteria. Now, I would say the greatest degree of confidence you have is when you see new lesions appear in a person, and especially if those lesions have a central vein sign. You're like, yes, this person's accumulating new MS lesions. I should probably treat this. But the reality is that, the criteria are criteria for diagnosis. They're not criteria for treatment. I think that's a point that we've made in the past about the criteria. I think the decision on whether to treat or not is a somewhat separate decision. It's based on many factors, how many lesions you have on the MRI. Have they accumulated recently? Do you have any enhancing lesions on the MRI? Do you have any spinal cord lesions? What's your risk appetite, right? Are you a person who's a little bit more conservative or a little bit more like, I just want to nip this in the bud? So I think a lot of factors go into that decision making. But I think, to reflect on your question, definitely avail yourself of those specific biomarkers that are going to predict an attack of a multiple sclerosis.
A great breakdown. Because, like I said, I think there's still some people. There was so much introduced in these guidelines, and to kind of take all of them into account and kind of figure out how you're going to go about, diagnosing a patient and making sure that you're factoring everything into that kind of decision, I think has still been something that's been a little bit of a challenge for some clinicians. And we've heard from the clinical community about kind of that translation to clinical practice. You mentioned dissemination in time. So, obviously, I wanted to call out that only 4% of the cohort, met dissemination in time. So, in your opinion, does that reflect something biological about these atypical presentations, or is it more about limited access to historical imaging for these patients specifically?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a combination. So, I think the reality is that, if in order to determine dissemination in time, you have to have either enhancing and non-enhancing lesions on the same scanner, which doesn't happen as often, especially in a person who hasn't had an attack, right? So it's relatively going to be less common in an RIS patient, relatively less common in a person who has symptoms not specific for MS. So that's one thing. And I think the second one is that these people typically had their first MRI and they quickly came to see a MS provider, right? So the time between when they kind of had that first MRI to when they went into the study was relatively short. So they didn't have a lot of opportunity to have those repeat MRIs. Now we'll see what the data shows. We've scanned all these patients at 24 months. We're still conducting that analysis. So we'll see how many of those patients, then transition to have new lesions on an MRI, so i.e. DIT. And then the question is, does cerebrospinal fluid that's positive, or is, the presence of, CVS a predictor of having to go on to develop those new lesions?
And that kind of brings me to my last question. You kind of mentioned kind of the 24-month sort of follow-up, and not just for the 24-month follow-up specifically, but with these new diagnostic criteria, what are you and your clinicians and your colleagues sort of looking for, or goals that you're trying to pay attention to for the long run of the application of these guidelines? Just talk a little bit about it from the CAVS MS perspective, but also just from a field perspective. What kind of questions, what sort of things that we need to be kind of paying attention to that maybe we want to make sure that it all pans out the way that we thought it would, over the next couple of years, so that we don't look back and we say, hey, we actually got it wrong. These things maybe shouldn't be included, or, maybe we jumped the gun or a little bit or whatever it may be.
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. And I think part of what you always do as a scientist and as a researcher is you try to evaluate if the changes you've made, in any given guideline, diagnostic criteria, we know that they're not forever, right? We know they have to be reviewed and revised based on new data that becomes available and also based on kind of what the uptake is from the clinicians that might be practicing and how they use it. I would say that the criteria remains simple in their design. What changes and what has made it complicated for neurologists is the fact that we're now applying it in two categories that we haven't applied it in the past. And on top of that, we have If you count kappa free light chains as an additional biomarker, we're talking about four new biomarkers. One is optic nerve, the other one is CVS, PRLs, and kappa free light chains. And so, there's not as much familiarity with some of these measures. Specifically, kappa free, CVS, and PRL are quite new. A lot of people haven't been using them in practice. But one of the things that I like to say about diagnostic criteria is that there's two purposes diagnostic criteria have. One, they level set. So what I'm calling MS in my clinic now in 2024, when we wrote the criteria, it should be what's in the criteria. What didn't make sense was, we had these RIS patients that we were treating with MS medications, but we couldn't call them MS, right? That's one thing. It's level setting, saying, yeah, what everybody agrees is MS should be codified in the criteria. And the second thing it does is it's forward thinking. It's let's move the field forward. Let's start using measures that we think probably can make diagnosis more accurate. And I think the CVS and the paramagnetic rim lesion and kappa free light chains are all examples of those types of measures, measures that we can utilize in clinical practice that, can be done on the same MRI we're already using to make a diagnosis of MS and just give us greater confidence.
Yeah, I mean it's a big shift, obviously, to kind of go from a lot of what we were doing with symptoms, beforehand, and kind of focusing on EDSS and things of that sorts, and now obviously kind of going mainly just to a biological construct and really kind of seeing and diagnosing patients from that end of things. But as always, Dr. Antoneta, we always appreciate your breakdown and insights as usual. So thank you again for taking some time out of your day, and it was nice to chat with you as always. So
Yeah.
appreciate it. Thank you.
Great to meet you, Marco. Thanks so
Thank you,
much.
Dr. Antoneta. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.